From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Sean Howe is my guest. His book, Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, is now out in softcover, and it's a fascinating history of the most influential comic book publishers, the home of Spider-Man, X-Men, Captain America, and Night Nurse. Sean Howe, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hey, thanks a lot.
You know, in The Wizard of Oz, the great and powerful Oz is revealed to be this ordinary humbug, and to some degree, I think Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, performs this similar unveiling. Marvel Comics, I guess it wasn't the carefree bullpen of wacky creators that the bullpen pages had me believe when I was 12.
Yeah, I fell for the same ruse, I guess. And, you know, I'm okay with that. You know, when so many of us were kids growing up and reading the comics, there was, you know, the additional bonus of feeling like we were part of this secret club. And the letters pages were just filled with this, you know, conspiratorial tone, and you really felt like, you know, I've been thinking about how it was kind of the first time that a workplace was marketed as somewhere that you would like to be. It was the Marvel bullpen was made out to be like an Elves factory, and you know, I guess. You know, a lot of companies have taken a page from that. I mean, if you look at all the internet entities that live blog and try to make you feel like part of the family, Marvel was really kind of reaching out a hand and you know, bringing you along for fun adventures. And all those people who were inkers and pencilers and letterers, you sort of felt like they were like an extended family.
I did. I even got a no prize once for...
You did?
Yeah, for one of my letters that I wrote.
What year was that?
67, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, I started...
Golden age.
Yeah, I started collecting comics in 1966, and then my first comic was Superboy, and a friend of mine had a copy of Spider-Man number 11, I think it was, where Doc Ock unmasks Peter Parker, but nobody believes that he's really Spider-Man. And I thought, wow, that was really good. It was much better than Superboy because it had continuity that Superboy lacked. That is, at the end of Superboy, everything that happened, it didn't matter what happened because everything started the same in the next story, whereas stuff that happened to Spider-Man made a difference in the next issue.
Right, and, you know, I would say that, you know, right there are two of the big selling points for Marvel, in a sense, is the fact that you felt like you were, you know, part of this, they called it the Mary Marvel Marching Society, it was the fan club. You felt like that, and then also the continuity of the stories themselves was, you know, I know for me that was something that just kept me coming back. And now you see that with television all the time. You know, there's, I guess, you know, it's something inherited from soap operas, but Lost and Mad Men and Breaking Bad, you know, all these are worlds that people get heavily invested in, and you know, the TV shows expect that you have kind of, you know, done the homework all along, and there's rewards for having paid close detailed attention, and Marvel Comics was, you know, kind of a real pioneer in that kind of storytelling. I mean, certainly there had been serial narratives before, but this was like a universe that you just kind of delved into. And whereas DC Comics, it was, you know, everything starts over with the next issue.
Yes, your book pointed out that the interconnectedness of Marvel was really intense. That is, Superman both appeared in Superman in Action and also in this Justice League, but none of those stories had anything to do with each other. Whereas you point out that in Marvel, every story it took place in the same world, and so if something happens to Spider-Man in his guest starring Daredevil, then that happened to Spider-Man.
Yeah, I'm not sure why that. I guess there's something about, you know, just being able to just fully leap into this other world, especially if you're from a small town like I was, you know, it was kind of like, here's this full color universe that has no limits, that, you know, you can just disappear right into it.
It wasn't until I was a little older and started reading older comics from before my time that I realized how many of the things that Stan Lee, the voice of Marvel Comics, so to speak, had actually taken from other places. Even the bullpen is kind of like EC Comics that had been going on there. And even the Mary Marvel Marching Society, Fawcett Publications, who published Captain Marvel and Mary Marvel, had a Mary Marvel Marching Society also, but was spelled differently.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that, actually. Somebody pointed that out to me, and I guess that didn't make it into the book. But yeah, that's probably actionable, you know. except Fawcett always lost their lawsuits.
That's right. They always just back down, I think, rather than.
Yeah.
So your book is really about, it's really three stories. It's the people who made the comic books. It's the characters that are in the comics, and it's the business of comics, and you very artfully wove all three of these aspects back and forth. I want to talk a little bit about the Lee Kirby controversy, that is, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. Tell us a little bit about the background there.
Yeah, so I guess it's always such a hard thing to synopsize, but I guess to give a little bit of history of the company, you know, a guy named Martin Goodman had success publishing pulp magazines, and he saw that comic books were going to be a way to make some extra money. A fad, thanks to Superman, was, you know, superhero comics were really big in the late 30s, and so he outsourced at first, hired another company to put together all the magazines. Before long, he realized that if he could get somebody in-house to do it, then he could maybe pay a little less. So he got a couple guys, Jack Kirby and Joe Simon. And right off the bat, they came up with Captain America, which was a ripoff of another comic book called The Shield, but but it did really well. Kirby and Simon got the idea that Marvel wasn't really, or rather Martin Goodman wasn't, you know, paying what he owed them, and they planned to jump ship. Before they actually did it, somehow Martin Goodman found out, and, you know, years later there would be sort of insinuations that maybe Stan Lee, who was at the time a young, like, office assistant.
He was the Fink, yeah. He had Finked on them.
Well, that was something that I think Joe Simon kind of floated out there in a book he wrote, and you know, I mean, it's certainly plausible, but you know,
so
no one will know.
There was a little bit of bad blood then before the Kirby Lee teaming of the 1959 or 60.
Yeah, I mean Stanley Lieber was actually a relative of Martin Goodman, and he was the pesky little gopher kid who was, you know, he was kind of like a gnat flying around bugging Simon and Kirby. So they took off, went over to National Publications, now known as DC, and Kirby, you know, was. Both of them were pretty successful for a while. Flash forwarding, you know, almost 20 years, Stan Lee has, you know, he's now editor of Marvel Comics, which is really a skeleton crew of people. It's pretty much him and, you know, a secretary. Jack Kirby finds himself in a position where he has to come back to Marvel and work. So there was already a little bit of kind of weird dynamics between the two of them. And it was a couple years after that the Fantastic Four appeared. There's, you know, who actually did the heavy lifting of creating the Fantastic Four, who decided that, is something that is about as agreed upon as, you know, if there was a conspiracy to assassinate JFK.
Right.
So anyway, the Lee Kirby team in whatever, you know, whatever work split came up in a couple years with the Fantastic Four and the Hulk and Daredevil and Iron Man and a revival of Captain America that was also hugely popular, the Hulk,
Thor,
the X-Men. You know, this is like a 3-year period.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, it's
pretty amazing.
It's almost like, well, you know, maybe it was the times, you know, the 1960s, because it was also the time that the Beatles made all their great records and all this other great music happened, and it was all this time with great movies and something like that. So
yeah.
I don't know, it could have had something to do with that. And also, when I think about who was more responsible, you know, Kirby, of course, claims that he created them all, and Stan Lee says he created them all, that, you know, it's a lot, it reminded me of the whole, the Beatles again, because, you know, when Lennon and McCartney split, there was who wrote which song and who did what. Neither of them ever did anything as great. They did work, but they never did anything as great as they had done as the Beatles, and that's probably true with Kirby and Lee, too.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there are a lot of people who think, you know, after Kirby left Marvel in 1970, a lot of people think that his work immediately after that was better. I'm not one of those people, but...
If it were better, then wouldn't there be a Mr. Miracle movie instead of a Spider-Man movie or a Fantastic Four movie, whatever?
Well, you know, I guess it's tricky to argue, you know, that commercial success is directly proportional to
quality. Merit. Yes.
Because, you know, the Fantastic Four movie, for instance, is
terrible.
Terrible.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's interesting, by the way, we're talking with Sean Howe, and his book is called Marvel Comics, The Untold Story. I don't think any superhero movie, and when I was a kid, we never dreamed there would be these kinds of superhero movies that they make now. I don't think any superhero movie is anywhere near as good as the best that the comics have to offer.
I agree. Yeah. I guess there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, one is that, you know, superheroes are just so inherently just stylized, you know, it's really hard for me sometimes to accept that people talk about comic book movies rather than superhero movies, because it sort of you know, shuts out the whole other world of comic books. You know, there's a whole wide range of great works that are part of that medium, but also it you know, the comic book movies don't have what a Jack Kirby or a Steve Ditko panel has. There's just something, you know, that's very special about that artwork, and you know, I would love for the public, you know, at large, to appreciate, you know, what Gene Colan is more than maybe appreciating Iron Man.
Right, right.
But
each artist brought their own unique thing to the character.
Yeah, and they're so, you know, they're really brilliant artists, and as much as people like to say that, you know, comic books have, you know, have transcended the labels that people gave them. You know, the superhero comics at their best are still, you know, either looked down upon or kind of dismissed.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously, the success of these movies has shown that people care a great deal about the characters and the stories, but for whatever reason, you know, these guys aren't household names.
Well, it's interesting. I guess because Well, I guess partially you'd say that, you know, a comic book is supposed to appeal to 150 or 200,000 people, whereas the movie has to appeal to millions and millions of people. But you'd think if they were going to make a Daredevil movie, which they did, and they had, if they had taken Frank Miller's wonderful run on Daredevil, I don't see how you could go wrong. You could have even made a movie of his second run that you mentioned in the book, the Born Again run.
Mm-hmm.
That would have made a great movie, but instead they made a really terrible movie.
Yeah, and they used a lot of ideas from Frank Miller, and certainly, you know, Daredevil was not nearly as much of a noir character before Frank Miller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when Gene Colan drew him, he was a happy-go-lucky guy.
Yeah, and so, you know, obviously the movie took from that darkness, but, you know, you can't replicate the way that those comics look. I mean, that's just something that, you know, I think of Ben Affleck in that suit, and I was looking forward to a Daredevil movie, you know, probably since I was like 7 years old. It was, you know, that's what I really wanted more than anything else.
You know, they can do so much with full animation. I don't know why they've never done a fully animated, you know, like the Superman cartoons of the Fleischers are good examples. Why they've never made a fully animated superhero movie?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that. That has always been that's always been what I thought would be the perfect solution, is like a rotoscoped comic book. You know, if you look at a movie like A Scanner Darkly, you know, that kind of look would be really terrific for, you know, some of these characters that just look kind of ludicrous when you dress someone up. And you've already got Robert Downey. You already know how to use his face in the transformation because he was in that movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess there have been some animated ones, and we're wrong. Even a couple theatrical ones. I think Batman and the Mask of Phantasm or something like that was in theaters, but never a great big budget, full blown.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it would be so
right.
Cool.
And you know, you could argue that some of those animated Batman cartoons capture.
Oh yeah, that television series was great.
Yeah, you know that's a lot closer to Batman for me than any of the TV shows or movies.
When I was a kid, I enjoyed those cartoons that you mentioned in your book, the Mighty Marvel superhero cartoons that were just panels. You know, they were Kirby or Dick Ayers panels with narration applied and sound effects.
Yeah. Those aren't on those 1966 cartoons are not on DVD. And I think that's a shame because it would be a lot of fun to be able to watch those without straining one's eyes on YouTube.
We're talking with Sean Howe, and his book is called Marvel Comics: The Untold Story, and it's a great book. I had a great time reading it. Comic books today are different for a number of reasons, and I still enjoy reading comics a lot today, and I think the writing is pretty good. But more happened in, you know, when Captain America and Iron Man shared Tales of Suspense, that is, the comic only had there was only a half story. There was more that happened in a half of a comic book then than happens in six issues now. They were densely written.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's more about how densely they were written then or how porous they are now. They you know, it's what's the word that they use? Decompression, I guess. The decompressed style of storytelling. You know, there's a lot of people that argue that the way that they really let the story stretch out now, a lot of people would argue that that's part of the reason that you know, comic books aren't as popular anymore. I'm not sure that I go along with that, because to me, you know, the artwork is such a big part of it anyway. But certainly when you're paying $4 for a comic book, which is the, you know, the kind of the average price of a single issue these days. You know, it's tough to swallow the idea that, you know, you're going to get 1/6 of a story.
Do have the writers and artists that you've interviewed for your book, are they interested in the speed? Do they want to alter the speed that it takes for a reader to read the comic?
You know, that's something that hasn't really come up. I think, you know, I mean, part of it is a lot of people that I talk to are no longer in the business.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, do you mean would they want to speed it up
or slow it down?
You know, I think that probably has as much to do with the production process. You know, just like kind of moving things along for the writers and the way that you know, the stories are planned pretty bureaucratically these days, and there's a lot of coordination, you know, between the Hollywood goals and, you know, the comic book company's output. You know, I think it's a very good question. It's not one that has really, you know, come up in my conversations, and I will start asking those questions.
I'm just interested in that. Yeah. I mean, when you talked about Steranko, and he would have several pages without any dialogue, they didn't want to pay him for writing the story.
Yeah. Jim Steranko, who was kind of the guy who made Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. A big deal. You know, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee had started it off, and then this kind of much younger guy, Jim Steranko, came along and really kind of made it such a contemporary comic book. So S.H.I.E.L.D. of like 1967 is, you know, a lot of pop art influences and a lot of film influences, and, you know, it's kind of like Godard coming, and, you know, where it was just Howard Hawks before and Orson Welles, you know, here comes this totally new thing that synthesizes what came before, but feels totally of the moment. Jim Steranko, I don't know if you've seen this, but he's now doing recaps of S.H.I.E.L.D. episodes for The Hollywood Reporter.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that. I want to, though.
They're pretty entertaining. You know, he doesn't mince words. I find him such a really fascinating personality anyway. I mean, he's really a character. I would recommend following him on Twitter as well if you do that kind of thing.
I have to make a note of that. Well, he influenced me when I was a kid. I mean, I just loved him. You know, I would search for his stuff, and it was always a disappointment when, you know, he would be on a title and then suddenly there would be a fill-in issue that he didn't draw, I guess, because it took him so long to draw them, I suppose.
Right. Or there were the times that he would do a cover and the inside would just
some
not
some other guy.
Franco.
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, you know, pity the guy who had to bear the brunt of disappointment from all those readers.
And you can see how some of these creators today would be bitter over the fact that billions of dollars are being made on their creations without any compensation for them.
Yeah, you know, in some circumstances they knew what they were getting into. In many circumstances, you know, it was a lot more ambiguous than that. I mean, generally the more recent creations, you know, people kind of had learned, you know, from seeing what happened to their predecessors, you know, they were kind of going in with, you know, with a clearer sense of the business realities. Yeah, you know, the history of comics is just filled with heartbreak and guys who brought so many, you know, exciting ideas to the table, and, you know, then got kind of shown the door. It's something that is, you know, I think it's kind of the great tragedy of Marvel Comics history, you know, is the eternal, you know, battle between art and commerce. You know, and when you become a publicly traded company, commerce is going to win.
It seems to me in your book that the people at the tippy top of the comic books industry are the people with the shortest sight as to what is a valuable property and what they could do with it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I sometimes feel a little more pragmatic about it, and sometimes I get onto sort of an anti-corporation soapbox, but you know, the truth is if you put the financial considerations aside, you know, it's really sad that people refer to these creations as, you know, like Marvel Comics Avengers, you know. You don't have, you know, Huckleberry Finn, you know, isn't referred to as, you know, I don't remember who the publisher
Gossett
was.
And Dunlap's,
yeah.
Huckleberry Finn, right. I mean, it's always, right. We never hear Tarzan without Edgar Rice Burroughs, but you often hear of Spider-Man without Steve Ditko or whatever.
You know, it's something that is obviously a great it's a source of bitterness, not just for the creators, but for a lot of the comic book fans who, you know, understandably, you know, can't get past the fact that Jack Kirby, you know, never got either the recognition or the money that he deserved.
When I saw the Spider-Man movie, I was pleased to see that Steve Ditko got a credit, but really it should have been Romita who got the credit, because it was his Spider-Man, I think, they made the movie about.
Well, and that's the other thing about comic book creators is, you know, as much as I think it's important to recognize the creator of the, you know, the original concept, there's so much that's like, it's like, you know, the exquisite corpse, you know, the concept of somebody passing along something and then the next person running with it. And it's really hard to chart, you know, who contributed more. If you look at, you know, almost any of the comics, it's you know, the X-Men were really nothing until 1975 when, you know, guys who had nothing to do with Lee and Kirby kind of came along. You know, Dave Cockrum had all these characters in a notebook, and you know, that's where Storm and Nightcrawler and Colossus, you know, they all came from the notebook of some guy who had created those characters before he even walked in the door at Marvel Comics.
Right, right. And now, of course, those characters are again generating millions of dollars for somebody.
Right, right. And you know, it's easy to kind of shake one's fist at that, but you know, in some cases, you know, the creators got paid fairly, and you know, like I said, in many cases they did not.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's a hard thing to sort of keep straight which is which.
The book is called Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, and the author is Sean Howe. Sean, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
It was a real pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see me again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can also subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Sean Howe, his book, Marvel Comics, The Untold Story. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.